I found your book really very interesting, and it kind of raised all sorts of ideas in me. But for someone who hasn't read it, I would like you to say, you know, what the setting is, and give me some idea of why you chose what is a very unusual set of circumstances to turn into a novel, to imagine into a novel.
Okay, to summarise the story, it's a story of an Indian family that runs a zoo in Pondicherry in southeast India. It's in the 70s, political conditions are bad, so they decide to immigrate to Canada. So they close down the zoo, and most of their animals are going to zoos in the United States. So since they're all going to the New World, they decide to share the same cargo ship to cross the Pacific. Unfortunately, the cargo ship sinks, and there are five survivors. There's Pai Patel, Life of Pai, the book's called, and that's after the main character's nickname. There's Pai Patel and four animals, a zebra with a broken leg, a hyena, an orangutan, and a tiger. And quickly, the only animal left is the tiger. And so most of the novel is the relationship between Pai and the tiger as they drift across the Pacific for 227 days. And then the end of the novel is they reach land in Mexico, to be precise, and there's an investigation as to what happened. So that's the plot, and the theme. One of the things I like about my own book, if I can toot my horn, is that it's a story where the story is one thing and the theme is something else, and you sort of forget what the theme is until the very end. Because I throw this gauntlet down at the beginning in the author's note that this is a saying that this is a story that will make you believe in God. And yet there's hardly any talk of religion, really. In part one, there is some talk, because Pai practices three religions, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity. So there's some talk of religion there. But then for the vast majority of the novel, for the good all of part two, there's hardly any discussion of religion. And yet at the very end, it comes up again. And so the theme of the novel, in fact, is quite religious, in the broadest sense of the term. It is a story. I do mean this quite literally, actually, when I say this. It's not meant as a metaphor or anything, but it is a story meant to make you believe in God. God, once again, defined in the broadest way possible, not necessarily the Western, paternalistic, overly personalized form of God. More, I usually say they use the expression, the greater plan, to make you believe in a greater plan. So that's the theme, the greater story.
Is that your... Does it in some way reflect some sort of spiritual journey that you have gone through in your own life? I mean, is it reflecting your own belief?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I wrote this book because I was interested in the various themes. There's also a strong animal element because they run a zoo. For sure. So yeah, I'm on a quest. I think like most writers, we are like most people. I'm trying to make sense of life. What's it all about? Why things are the way they are? What's my role here? Do I have a role? And I've gone, like every writer, that I come from a certain context. Quebec, where I come from, is for the last 30, 40 years been a strongly anti-clerical, anti-religious society. There's a thing, in Quebec history, the 30s, 40s, and 50s is now called the Great Darkness. In the early 60s, there was something that we call the Quiet Revolution, which is where Quebec suddenly freed itself from the shackles of religion. So in a matter of really 2-3 years, churches emptied themselves, all kinds of priests and bishops defrocked. And so Quebec suddenly went from being the most backward province in Canada to being the most liberal, forward-looking. And so a whole generation of people of that generation of the 50s and 60s are fiercely anti-clerical. So I had a completely agnostic upbringing. God, they didn't say anything disparaging about religion, but it just was neutral. And so I had a no religious upbringing, and having studied philosophy at university, I sort of had an intellectual bias against religion, because the first thing you do when you study philosophy is you cut to shreds all the proofs of gods that, you know, Thomas Aquinas came up with, Descartes. You cut those apart. It's a very easy mental exercise to hone your intellectual skills. But I just found that things were... A certain perspective was missing in my life, so that sort of set me on a certain path. And part of my research for Pi is I started attending Mass at a Catholic church in Quebec. And while I was in India for a year, I'd go to mosques and Hindu temples. And I did find that once you scratch the surface and you actually go back to the texts, religion, defined very broadly, is an amazing subject. It's incredibly interesting. If you get beyond all the stupid things that have been done in the name of religion, and there's certainly a lot of stupid things that have been done in the name of religion, if you get beyond that, now I can't imagine something not being interested in that topic, not wanting to, not necessarily believe it. I mean, doubt's a part of any belief, but at least to play with that language, to at least be familiar with that story and play with it. I cannot see how it wouldn't enrich someone's life. I said, you have to, there's a big difference between God and the church. You can drop the church. I really don't care about the Roman Catholic Church. That's what's fascinating too about religions, is that they are very distinct. I mean, I think fundamentally, one thing I noticed doing my research is the mystics of every language speak the same language. It's a language of love, a language of a personal God. But it doesn't mean that the religions are the same. So in fact, they are extremely distinct. So the letting go of the self, the forgetting of oneself, is a very Buddhist perspective. But actually in Christianity, and also in Islam, it is a very much a religion that is centered on the I, which is not, doesn't mean that it's egocentric, but that the perspective of the individual and his assent to what is happening is very important. Which was interesting. So every religion I've noticed also has its advantages and its disadvantages, flaws and its qualities. So what's interesting about religion is, because everything is based on, to some extent, on the I and on assent, redemption is possible in a, with a moment's thought. You know, if you truly are asking, if you truly regret something and ask forgiveness, it's granted right away, because all you needed is the, is that assent. Whereas it's true in Hinduism, and to some extent in Hinduism, there is this idea that the self is an illusion, and that you must let go, and you are part of a greater whole, of a greater plan. Each one is valid. That's what I thought was interesting, is every religion. One thing I've noticed, for example, is Christianity. The key word is love. Love comes over constantly in the New Testament. Whereas in Islam, what comes strongly through is fraternity, is the idea of the brotherhood and the sisterhood of humanity. And you see that in the way they practice. There's a very strong feeling of brotherhood in Islam. Let's forget all the stupid things that Islam has done and all the negative things that people think about it. When you enter a mosque, there's a strong sense of egalitarianism. Where you sit to pray is irrelevant. You're a pauper, you're the president of a bank, it's all the same. Whereas in a Catholic church, you know, the pews at the front are for the richer people, the poor people are at the back. You're dressed in your Sunday best. Mosque doesn't matter where you sit. Very strong egalitarianism. Before I became interested in religion, the life buoy I was sort of clinging to was arts. And I think a lot of people do that of my generation. I'm 38. You know, we were never brought up with religion. And to us, arts is the life buoy, and also sometimes politics, you know. These are alternatives. These are secular religions, since communism, or, you know, hugging the earth, you know, saving the earth, saving the environment. These are life. But the problem I have with that, that I encountered eventually, is that art is always intramural. It's always within the bounds of the human existence. And art, to me, is very much descriptive. So it goes to what you're saying, you know, you can view this world in many different ways, historical, social, political. But these always stay within the bounds of the limit of life and death. It always stays within. The only thing that goes beyond, that becomes extramural, is a religion that goes beyond the here and the now, the time and space restraints, and say, well, what if there's something greater beyond it? What if all this that we see is just like an island floating on something much deeper? And it's only religion that makes that great leap, in many cases a leap of faith, beyond that, to try to create a greater context. And that's what fascinates me endlessly now. It's not, I mean, I do like the ritual of religion, actually. There's so little ritual in our life, that even the small ritual of Christians, of doing the sign of the cross, because so much we do in our life is for a reason, a commercial reason. And there's nothing wrong with that, you know, we do eat bread, we do live on this earth. But what I love about religion, I do like the ritual. But beyond that is also this trying to grasp this greater mystery.
You have encapsulated in your very title one of the mysteries, which presumably that was conscious, because pi is we might call it a magical number.
Irrational.
It's an irrational number, a number which is infinite. Yeah. They have never found the end of it, have they?
No. It has no discernible pattern to it. Yeah.
So tell me about why. Well, the two things I see in your title are that, you've got that, and I think, isn't there one of the Hindu gods, that there's a notion that life is, someone told me this, I may be wrong, but it's the urine of
of Ganga, of the river Ganges.
No, what's the big one, not Vishnu.
There's Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva.
Shiva, and that this world is like in urine of
Shiva. Oh, I hadn't heard that one.
Well, listen,
Hindu mythology is so rich. It's like Greek mythology. It's extraordinarily
funny, so you
rich.
You haven't heard that because you've actually got the guy's name, Pi. His name is Piscine, P-I-S-C-I-N-E.
Piscine, yeah, water, yeah.
But also he was nicknamed Pisser, and I thought he meant that.
That's an interesting... No, that would be coincidence. That would be serendipity.
Perhaps you picked up things by osmosis in India.
Perhaps,
that you didn't really...
That's a very good one. But the title, actually, I love... once again, I wrote this book, so obviously I like it. But I love the title. First of all, I get annoyed when people say The Life of Pi. I did not want an article.
I didn't say that, yeah.
Because it's a definite article. And, you know, there are many lives possible. One thing that's very important in Hinduism... one of the key words in Hinduism is darshan. And darshan means viewing the murti, which is at the core of a Hindu temple. It's the little
murti.
Murti is like what we call it, a little doll. It's an incarnation of God resident, God residing in that temple. And so that's why the doll is dressed up and it's fed, because you have to feed God, you have to wash God, you have to take care of him. And it's very important for a Hindu to see that. And that's a literal meaning, you have to see it, but the more metaphorical meaning is that point of view is important. There's a multiplicity of views in Hinduism, which is why it's mistaken to say that Hinduism is a polytheistic religion. It's not really. Yes, there are millions of gods, but they're all different facets of the same fundamental reality. So at heart, in fact, Hinduism is not a polytheistic religion. It is a monotheistic religion. There is one reality, but with many different facets to it. So I didn't want a definite article because the life implies a single life. A life, possibly, but that didn't sound right. So just life of Pi. And Pi, you're right, Pi is an irrational number, which means it goes on forever. Which in a sense to me, it goes on forever, which means it's infinite. And yet life is unnecessarily finite. I like that contrast.
Because what is Pi? Tell me, what is it? 22?
3.1415926.
Yeah,
and what it is, it's the ratio...
Over 7 or something.
Yeah, 21 over 7. 20, no, 22
over
7.
7.
But that's not correct. It's not exactly 22 over 7. But what it is, it's the ratio of, you know, you have a circle. You take the diameter, and you put the diameter around on the circumference. It'll go around once, twice, three times, and then a little bit more.
And
that
little bit more
is the 1.1415926. It goes on forever. There's no pattern.
And no one has ever managed, even the big computers,
to
reach an end of that series.
No, no. It repeats itself, and there's no pattern. It's not like, you know, 3.14141414. No, it goes on with no discernible pattern.
Because
and that in mathematics is called an irrational number. And what I loved is that in math we use this irrational number to come to a rational understanding of the universe. Just as it's hard to be a mystic, it's hard to be a true scientist. I think most of us, in our society anyway, I see in Canada, I imagine the same elsewhere in Europe too, is the scientific approach tends to be reductionist. We tend to reduce things to what's the concrete, the here and the now and the literal, which to me is deadening to the imagination. And so the death of religion, which in many ways is a good idea, is to me is a part of the dying of the imagination, which is why we're always complaining how people are reading less, or they more and more like autobiography or current history books. They don't want fiction anymore because that's disturbing. They don't want flights of imagination. They somehow see it as being irrelevant. So that's a cancer, I think, on our modern consciousness. And it's very dangerous. If we don't have a sense of imagination, that means we can't imagine alternate worlds, which is very dangerous for democracy. So all these things are sort of linked. So to get back to I like the pie because it is irrational, and yet we use it to come to rational. So it's that mixture of practicality and rationality and the greater mystery. I like the way they and that's sort of encapsulated in the title. To me, life is an exaltation. It's such an amazing thing, life. There's so much richness to it. And it's not just what's out there, it's what we bring to it. And to get the full flavor, I think to a certain extent you have to suspend your disbelief. Same thing with, as I was saying, I was making this link to an imagination.
Full flavor of what, rather?
Full flavor of life. You have to bring your imagination to it. You have to suspend your disbelief.
Disbelief of what?
Well, to a certain extent of too much rationality, of the here and now. Let's take one concrete example since we're in Scotland. The Loch Ness Monster. To me, the worst thing you want to be in life is to be an agnostic. You remember that one point early on in the book, he says that the ones who get stuck in his car are agnostics, because they're overly rationalistic. They want, if there's not enough evidence to make you decide about religion, or about the Loch Ness Monster now, will there ever be enough for evidence? There's never going to be enough evidence if you're strictly sticking to a rational point of view. So whatever you do to get the full flavor of life, you must make a leap of faith. So for example, either the Nessie in the Loch Ness Monster either exists or it doesn't. You have to make that leap of faith. Either Atlantis exists or it doesn't. Either kangaroos exist or they don't.
But that actually applies to all sorts of human action, including moral. Moral, because there's nothing to prove that one code of behavior is better than another.
Exactly. So you're either an atheist, and that's a very brave faith. There is nothing, there's only now, and then we die, and that's it. or you believe in something greater. The worst thing is to be in between the two.
Well, that comes to the issue of choice and choice in the present moment.
Exactly, and that's a key element too, is in faith in anything, not just religious faith, in faith in loving someone, in faith in hating someone, frankly, there's an element of will. And that's why I start with this, it's amusing, and it's no one really get it, but I start with this sloth, which in its own way is a beautiful creature, but slothfulness is the worst thing you want to be. You must use will, and will implies seeing things and adding something to it, being part of it. So I see that in religion. To me, religion and fiction work in the same way. Both to work, you have to suspend your disbelief. So, you know, if you didn't like this novel, you'd say, well, I just couldn't believe that he'd be with the tiger. It didn't work for me. And so it wouldn't work because you couldn't suspend your disbelief. I, as a writer, didn't manage to make you suspend your disbelief. Same thing with the religion. You walk into a church, if it manages in some way to make you suspend your disbelief, and then that's what we call faith, somehow it transports you. Whereas if you don't, you sort of say, ooh, this is a cult. Let's get out of here. And most people are incapable of suspending their disbelief, not only with novels, but with religion. And ultimately, to me, that leads to a closing down of some closing down of the imaginative life, and it makes your life lesser, I think.
I think, actually, yes, I would agree that, I would agree to an extent in the sense of I agree with, about this engagement. My own feeling is that, actually, you know, the appearance may be that most people are close to this, but I think everyone's doing it all the time. I don't think that people are actually so close.
No.
Really, I think that people are very open, and I think that's actually why, you know, a book like yours can touch a strong chord in people, because it is a way of expressing something that is something that people are doing, even if they aren't doing it consciously.
Yeah.
You've got a philosophical training. That's your, well, as far as you have, then that's pointed your nose in the direction of being analytical about these things.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that you do it any more than someone who may never have analysed it.
Yeah, but I think I'll disagree to the extent that there has to be an element of consciousness. And don't forget, I'm coming from my context of North America. To give another example of the flattening of reality, is these new things called reality TV shows? You know, these
yes.
like Survivor.
Yes.
Well, see, there we don't even want the illusion of fiction now. We really want it to be reality. There's a sort of flattening in the American imagination, which of course necessarily affects the Canadian imagination, because there looks like these new buildings around your little flats that's overshadowing us. There's a certain flattening and a uniformization of a mainstreaming of all thought, which is extremely dangerous.
I agree with that.
That's why you have to be conscious of it, and either you go with it or you go against it. Whatever you do, you have to make a decision. And so that's why, to me, the element of will, which to me was sort of a surprise, to realize that the greater plan won't come and hit you on the head with a stick. No, you must go towards it. You must make that. It doesn't happen passively. And that's applies not only to religious faith, but faith in democracy. All these things imply will. Like you were just talking about you making an effort to save your little block of flats from this development. You have to make that effort. If you just sit there passively, everything goes by you.
Yeah.
Pies at sea for 227 days with a tiger. By dint of suffering, but also by, you know, ingenuity, he manages to survive. Yeah, it's still going. Keeping my eye on this. And so they get to the coast of Mexico, and after a few days, two Japanese investigators come down to his hospital. Because when a ship sinks, it's exactly like when a plane crashes. There's an investigation. Why did the ship sink? And they apply that knowledge to hopefully making other cargo ships safer. Now, there's no attention ever paid to ships sinking unless they have oil on them. Because ships are sinking all the time. No one cares about it because few people die and this doesn't really affect things. Anyway, these two Japanese investigators come down to visit Pai. And they say, well, what happened? We're interested in finding out why the Tsimshian sank. So could you explain to us what you saw? So Pai tells him this whole story of having survived, gets off on this tangent of explaining how he survived with this tiger. At the end of the interview, the Japanese say, well, that's very interesting. We'll just come back. We'll take a coffee break and we'll come back. They go away. They talk and they come back and say, listen, we don't believe your story, frankly. 227 days with a Royal Bengal tiger and a 26-foot lifeboat. I'm sorry, but we just don't believe that. You know, and your island, you have this carnivorous island, and then you meet this, you're blind on a lifeboat and you bump into another blind person in another lifeboat. We just can't believe this. It doesn't make sense. You know, please, what really happened? And Pai says, well, that happened. What can I tell you? This is what happened to me. And they say, we don't believe. And finally, Pai, exasperated, says, you don't believe my story? You want another story? You want a flatter story? Okay, I'll come up with another story. And he tells an alternate story, which is told in only 3-4 pages, which is far more brutal and more to the point, in a sense, more realistic. makes less of an appeal on the imagination. And the novel, the proof of God comes literally in the last two pages of the novel, where the investigators are about to leave. And just before they leave, Pi says, excuse me, wait a second. Because the other story doesn't explain the sinking of the ship either. The other ship involves four people instead of four animals and what happens to them. But neither story explains the sinking of the ship. It's just a mystery why the ship sank. There was rough weather, but it wasn't really a major storm. There might have been an explosion, but they're not sure. The cargo seemed to be legitimate cargo. There was no machinery, bombs that could explode, whatever. The sinking of the ship is a mystery. So the investigators conclude, well, we don't know why it sank. That's it. And they're about to leave, and then Pi says, wait a second. I told you two stories. Both have the same beginning. A ship leaves India. Both have the same ending. There's only one human survivor, me. And somehow I survived. Now, to you who weren't there, it doesn't make any difference which story is true. Whether I was there with animals or with human beings, it makes no difference. One story has animals, one story doesn't have animals. And Pi's question is, which is the better story? Not which is the truer story, but which is the better story? The story with animals or the story without animals? And the investigators think and they say, oh, well, the story with animals. Because the story without animals, with humans, is quite a horrifying story. And so, to me, the proof of God is applying that to religion. The theme of the Augustine summary is in exactly three lines. Life is a story. Two, you can choose your story. Three, a story with God is the better story. So let me go back over that. Life is a story. In other words, life is an interpretation. And that is scientifically true in the sense that we say grass is green. Well, to a dog, grass isn't green. It's because dogs are colorblind. We see. And you know how sometimes you see a color and you say, that's green. And someone says, no, that's not green. That's turquoise. Or that's blue. It's funny. It's the same reality, but we're seeing it in different ways. There's a scene early on in the novel where the two Mr. Kumars, one who's religious, one who's a scientist, are looking at the same animal, a zebra. And one says, Allahu Akbar, what a beautiful creature. God made such beautiful creatures. The other one says, this is Equus Burchelli Boemi, the scientific name of Grant's zebra. So it's the same reality, but they're viewing it differently. So life is an interpretation. So I say, life is a story. You know, life is how you take it. It isn't what's out there, it's how you take it. So that's step number one. You can choose your story. You know, we're both looking at the same reality. You could be completely depressed. You can go home and commit suicide. I'll go home and be in a perfectly good mood. It's the same reality. It's how we interpret it. One day you're in a good mood, one day you're in a bad mood. Why? It's because you're interpreting your reality different. So there is an element of will in how you interpret that reality. And since there's an element of will involved, I argue that you might as well take the better story in each case. And the better story is one that has the greatest imaginative overlay. And the greatest imaginative overlay I can imagine is a religious one. There's no greater imaginative leap than one involving religion. Literature is also an imaginative leap, but not as great as religion. And religion always implies stories. So you might as well choose a religious perspective.
Well, you're saying God, but which God? Then?
Oh, that doesn't matter.
Or you don't mind?
No, I don't really. And that's
could
why
be the Greek gods.
Could be the Greek gods. Could be anything. In fact, it could be animism. It really doesn't matter. That's why I have Pi practice three religions. I'm not at all into faith with a small f. I'm a faith with a big F. I'm not into beliefs. Beliefs you cling. Faith you let go. So it is a great mystery. Mm-hmm. So to me, there are many aspects of the same reality. To me, there are different religions the way there are different cuisines. There are different foods. There is a sociocultural element to religion. We don't eat all the same food because we live in different realities. Well, that's reflected in how we encounter the great plan.
So that means that no religion is right as such. No particular religion and no religion is right
or is wrong.
And no religion is wrong.
Exactly. They're all. Which doesn't mean that they're all the same. I mean, Buddhism is very. Buddhism doesn't even speak of God. Buddhism is nearly an atheistic religion in the sense that there's a greater plan. They don't even use the word God. Whereas some are, Islam is, there's definitely a God. There's a very different flavor to them. So it'd be like saying, all foods are the same. Well, it's ridiculous. Scottish food is very different from Indian food, is very different from French food, is very different from Italian food. Just as Catholicism is different from Protestantism, from Judaism, from Islam, from Sufism, just as all life is different. We're different from dogs. In Montreal, I volunteered a palliative care unit. Okay. I volunteered a palliative care unit, which is care for the dying. So every Thursday morning, I spend time with people who are dying. And I've been doing that for the last 3-4 years. And we live in a society, and I'll say Canadian, but I imagine it's Western, who are in total denial of death. People don't die at home anymore. They die in hospitals. We're terrified of getting old. You know, cosmetic surgery is booming. There's this cult of youth. We're in complete denial of death.
Or the speed of life. Because once you've lived for even 20 or 30 years, you know that existentially, even if you live to 150, it's an incredibly short thing.
Yeah, it is. We're here only for a few minutes.
In our own terms of our own experience of it.
Right, and yet we don't seem to realize that. And so this blood and guts is part of life. I mean, we are, as you said, meat, you know, our brain is meat. We're like library books. We've been, you know, our body's loaned to us for a few minutes, and it will decay, and it's quite horrifying. But it is part of life, and that's why also what I like about religion is it addresses directly death. It tries to grapple. It grapples with death continuously, whereas art does occasionally, but not all the time. And if it does, it's more descriptive. You know, my father's death of cancer, and it describes it wonderfully. But it makes no sense of it. Religion tries to make sense of it. The feel of the book is very much realistic. It is gritty realism. I mean, it's a real tiger, real lifeboat, real turtles are butchered, real birds are captured and have their necks snapped. It really grapples with the reality of a castaway's life.
Yes.
Set adrift in the Pacific.
Very practical as well.
Very practical.
The description of the boat and
oh, you read this book, you will partly know how to survive if you ever get stuck in a lifeboat.
You begin to feel like that, don't you?
Yeah.
And that's so amazing because there are sort of rations or food on the boat, and but what is the thing? It's like one of these tests you've got to do. He's got to go past. What is the thing? He's got to go past the tigers then to get to the food or whatever.
Yeah.
And the tiger is on this big lifeboat. This is right at the beginning of.
Yeah.
He's facing his fear. Tell me what the tiger represents then.
Well, the tiger. Oh yeah, we're talking about the tiger. To me, the tiger represents many things. I was telling you about this alternate story that we get at the end, and there's this choice and. What the investigators realize is that Pi's other story has a parallel with the story with the animals. So, for example, in the alternate story, it's four human beings. One of whom is a Taiwanese sailor who, in jumping into the lifeboat, breaks his leg. And the Japanese investigators say, hey, that's interesting. His zebra has a broken leg, and his Taiwanese sailor has a broken leg. Oh. And in the other story, there's this French cook who's a brute, and he basically kills the Frenchman, the Taiwanese sailor with a broken leg, and he uses his body to fish. And he also eats part of his body. And so, now, hey, the hyena, and the Japanese say, hey, look, that's interesting. The Frenchman kills the sailor and eats him. The hyena eats the zebra. So they realize, oh, there's a parallel. He set up a parallel between the two. So there's a parallel. So the Taiwanese sailor is the zebra. The French cook is the hyena. Pai's mother is the orangutan. Which is a female, has two kids, and Pi has a brother. And so that means there's only one other animal left, that's the tiger. So the tiger is Pi. So one thing the tiger represents is the will to live. Is that element of will I was talking about, that you must make an element of will. So one thing, a tiger is fierce, although that's ridiculous. Actually, all animals are fierce. Anything is fierce when it wants to survive.
The fiercest looks.
It looks fierce. But, you know, a guinea pig...
Humans are fierce.
But a guinea pig is... A hamster is fierce. It's just that it's that small. But if you were this small and the hamster came up to you, you'd be terrified of the hamster. But anyway, a tiger is, as we understand it, is very fierce. And so, to an extent, the tiger is Pi himself. Is this thing that does not want to die. That wants to survive. And from that element of wanting to survive comes those imaginative leaps that make life possible. That make life go deeper, that give rise to religion. So to a certain extent, Pi is, the tiger Richard Parker is Pi himself. The tiger is also just what it is, a tiger. I mean, this is a practical novel, and also life is practical. You can't have airy-fairy beliefs. Like when I say life is the better story, that doesn't mean that the alternate story that you tell yourself, the better story, must be one that's rooted in reality. You know, you stand in front of a truck that's coming on at 100 miles an hour, you can tell whatever story you want. You're going to get run over by that truck and it's very painful. Your story must be rooted in reality, which is why when Pi tells his alternate story to the investigators, and he says at the end, which is the better story, he points out that it makes no difference to them. Whatever story he tells them, it makes no difference to the Japanese. The ship sinks, we don't know why. Pi is the only human survivor. So it's not like... It's not escapism. Religion is not escapism. That's what I love. It really does grapple. It's not like Lord of the Rings or some airy-fairy. No, religion really is rooted in reality. So to believe in Christ or to believe in Buddha or to believe in... You don't really believe in Muhammad. You believe in Islam. All those don't deny reality. They give it a greater depth. They give an interpretation on it, which does never denies reality, which to my mind explains why secular people, rationalists, always mock religious people, saying, how can they believe this shit? How can they believe Christ walked on water? How can they believe Christ resurrected Lazarus? It's such fucking bullshit. Well, you say that to religious people, and they just, it doesn't faze them for some reason. Even if they listen to your, you know, atheistic arguments, it just doesn't do anything to them. And it's always a mystery to reasonable people how people can believe in such unreasonable things as religion. Well, of course, the reason why is that religious people, these reasonable arguments are only part of the picture. And what they believe doesn't deny anything reason. Science doesn't deny, I mean, religion doesn't deny science. In fact, you mentioned Islam earlier. Islam is a very pro-science religion. And that's black and white in the Quran. Because they believe everything's the work of God. So I analyze this blade of grass, why it's green.
Well, they believe that everything has, for example, every illness has its cure in nature. It's all sort of provided.
And they believe in studying science.
Well, yes, they do.
You know, Muhammad said, there's one in the Quran, it's God who says this via Muhammad, but says, you know, talks about the wind and birds and rain and investigate that. It's the only religion that is explicitly pro-science. You know, Islam, the reason we had the Renaissance, this is common knowledge here, you know, the Renaissance came via the Muslims, who translated all kinds of texts, including these obscure Greek philosophers called Plato and Aristotle, which had completely vanished from Western consciousness, completely, and were only rescued because of Muslims who translated it from Greek to Arabic, and then because of the silk trade, Westerns who spoke Arabic discovered these obscure texts and say, oh, they're Greeks. Oh, this is really good ideas. We'll bring them back. And suddenly that set fire to the Renaissance. And why were these Muslims studying these texts? It wasn't just Greek texts. They were studying Persian texts, Indian texts, even African texts. They're translating everything. Why? Because this is all the work of Allah. We must study this world. I go to Catholic Church, but when I was in India, I used to go to Hindu temples and into mosques. And so I got the flavor of each one without having any bias. Other than that, in my personal life, well, I studied philosophy. That was years ago. I hardly remember anything about it, frankly. I traveled fairly widely because my parents were diplomats. So we were posted in a number of countries.
So which countries?
Well, let's see. Well, okay, I'll give you the chronology. I was born in Spain. We moved from Spain when I was 3 days old to Portugal. We spent a summer in Portugal. Then we moved to Alaska, where my father taught at the University of Alaska. Then we moved to British Columbia, where you've taught at the University of Victoria. Then you joined Canada's External Affairs, the equivalent of Foreign Affairs here, I suppose. And we moved to Ottawa, then to Costa Rica, then to Paris, then back to Canada, then to Spain, then to Ottawa, then to Mexico, then to Paris, then to Ottawa, then back to Paris. My parents were very lucky. They had 3 postings in Paris. They lived 12 years in France. So I followed along for the most part. And then I traveled on my own. I traveled extensively. I spent several months in Iran, in Turkey, in India, and traveled through South America. I've traveled a lot on my own, which actually doesn't say much. I mean, you can travel a lot and see nothing if you're closed-minded, just as you can stay in your own little village somewhere and have a great mind if you keep it open and you read and you travel the world with your mind. I mean, William Faulkner, you know, hardly ever left Oxford, Mississippi. Which I've never been there, but I'm assuming is some sort of hole in the middle of Mississippi, and yet he's a fantastic writer.